All right. Good morning, Tony. Or good morning here. I guess good afternoon to you.
Yes, it is very hot afternoon over here.
Tell me exactly where you are. I know you're in, I think, Northern Europe, but I don't know the details.
Actually, in Southern Europe.
Oh.
Close to Venice.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, so that part of the Mediterranean. It's not totally south, but it's very warm at the moment. Actually, there is a heat wave, so it's close to 40.
Yeah, well,
40 Celsius. I don't know in Fahrenheit, but it's.
I don't either. But I do know that when you hit 40, it's very hot. So. Well, what I have done since the last time we have chatted is I bought two of your books. I bought Shaman's Wisdom.
Yes.
And I bought The Simplicity of Love Meditation.
Wow.
And
okay.
I started reading Shaman's Wisdom first, and I got probably, I think it's to chapter 4 about the four maces or so, and I just felt like, you know, this isn't really what particularly interests me, although there were a couple of things in it that I do want to ask you about more about, but it didn't particularly interest me. And I was also, believe it or not, I bought the Kindle and having lots of trouble, like when I would try to turn the page, it would jump back 5 pages or it just wasn't working for me. So I thought, you know what, this isn't the one for me. Let me go to The Simplicity of Love Meditation. And I am very much enjoying that book. I'm a slow contemplative reader, so I haven't finished it, but I'm in around the middle of chapter 7, so I've done pretty well. I've gotten through about 3/4 of the book, I think.
Wonderful. I mean, Shaman's Wisdom was actually written with the help of a psychologist her interest is mainly shamanism, so of course the book was very focused on that aspect of spiritual tradition, you know, the shamanic realm of spirituality. But it's not actually the work that I do. But actually, this book is very, very popular. So it is, for us, the book that most people buy. and Simplicity of Love, which was basically written by me, is the one that sells least. So... I don't know why, but I like that book myself.
Yeah, that's the one that I like too. And that's, you know, that's the one that even after I finish reading it the first time, I might go back and read it a second time and a little more slowly. And that's probably the one that we'll talk about the most today.
That's good.
Let me just tell you a little bit again about my interests, and I think also then the interests of all of Awakening Together. And maybe that will help really fine-tune us.
Yes.
Awakening Together, well, obviously you can tell by the title, Awakening Together. Awakening Together is interested in what I'm going to call a true and honest spiritual awakening to reality and leaving everything that's not true, you know, kind of behind. So letting go. I noticed you mentioned letting go a lot in the Simplicity of Love Meditation. That's very important to us, learning to see our unconscious habits, learning to let them go, just knowing the difference between what is true and what is false and living from our true self, abiding from our true self rather than from our false self. So you can see why The Simplicity of Love Meditation interested me more.
Yes. I mean, the focus of that book is very much unlearning many of the habits that seem to be useful but in the end actually become negative in the sense that they limit one's potential, and so we get comfortable with certain ways of thinking or feeling that then crowd the space of the brain with all sorts of information that isn't relevant when you look at things from a new perspective or from a higher perspective. So unlearning is very much part of the thread in that book,
yes.
As you say, letting go.
Yes, and one question I asked you last time, which we really didn't get deeply into. In fact, I remember thinking, gosh, I asked the question and we didn't really go into it, but this book answers that question. And the question I asked you, I told you that, my method of undoing was more around contemplation and journaling, and that in fact I only started meditating about 6 weeks ago. I'm very new to meditation, and I mentioned to you that I was very interested to learn how the undoing process happens. I may have used the word purification though, and since we were using different words, that might have been why we didn't get into it. The undoing process happens during meditation. I was very curious about that, and this book addresses that. This book uses meditation in order to, well, undo and also I would say redo. You call it transformation, I think. Why don't you talk a little bit about what is transformation?
Yes, so you're right, actually. You know, the book is not a reference book. You know, this is how you meditate, A, B, C, and, you know, just go ahead and do that and everything will be good for you, because I feel that that is too simplistic when it comes to individuals. You know, we're all so very unique. We all have aspects within our unconscious, but also within our personality that depends on so many factors. It can't be that something works for everyone. So hence why the book is written more as a journal, you know, in a way where you can contemplate some aspects that may speak more to you if it's important, and other aspects that perhaps are relevant but maybe not so relevant for everyone. So, you know, it is written in a way where you can pick up here and leave something there, and it's an invitation to go deeper rather than telling you how to go deeper. Mm. And I think this, for me, is one of the most important points of transformation, that too many people, even in the spiritual tradition or in the New Age tradition, have this sort of attitude or way of doing things where people are being told how to do things. And actually, for me, it's more like poetry. There is an invitation to go a little bit deeper, but the invitation is sort of understood through your wisdom rather than putting wisdom in a certain way that then is sort of spoon-feeding someone to do this or to do that. So, for me, this is like an important, very important point when it comes to transformation. Because basically transcendence, which is transformation, transcendence means that you are able to recognize yourself in a certain situation or the problems and challenges that are happening in your life within a certain level of awareness. And because of that recognition, you're able to let it go. And by letting it go, you invite a grace of potential, or what I call a grace of many possibilities that were otherwise hidden behind the veil of confusion or challenges that were important in that moment. And as you let the problem go, so are there many answers invited into the space of consciousness that then become very interesting. And that is grace, or what I call transcendence to a new paradigm within the context of understanding reality and how you understand reality. So I think this is one point that I speak about on many different levels in the book that is perhaps forgotten in many spiritual traditions or New Age traditions, the uniqueness of a person and the importance of inviting what I call heartfelt connection to one's potential and to manifest that within oneself by emptying the pollution or the impurities, as you were saying. The purification process allows for this open space to happen naturally.
Yeah, every now and then I like to repeat what someone says, not only to check for understanding, but also, you know, sometimes when people are listening, how they can tune in and tune out. And I think if certain things that stand out, it's like highlighting something in a book. If something stands out, I like to repeat it. So a couple of things that you said I'd like to just kind of restate. One was, again, about each one really needs to learn how to find and follow their own inner wisdom rather than trying to copy something from the outside.
Very much. This is so very important. But even on subtle levels, we are doing this. It is not just, you know, many people think this to be an outside thing, you know, that people are reaching for goals and they look at heroes or people as references, their boss or their family or this person or that person. But actually, we also have those roles that we play within ourselves. So sometimes this is more difficult to understand. You know, it's easy to see if you, I don't know, if you have a guru on the outside and, you know, you see that person as wonderful. It's easy to see that because it's so tangible. But perhaps there are hidden aspects within one's personality that need to be let go of, and to understand that that is what you're doing to yourself, that you have certain points within that become almost a reference in the same way as people and other ways of doing things that then prevent you from being a natural, spontaneous, creative person and just finding your way.
Yeah. The other thing that you said, which fits very well with what you just now said, was that, and you didn't use these words, but you mentioned that we have habits or conditioning that we tend to just follow, and we need to learn to recognize these habits. And, you know, when we're about to act from them or about to speak from them, learn to recognize them for what they are, not helpful, and learn to literally in the moment let go. And then you were saying that if we in the moment let go, that allows an opening for what you call grace, or really for anything to happen.
Exactly. And in the moment, that's a very important part of the transformation, because so many people lay in bed, maybe, you know, in the evening when they can relax and think about all that's happened during the day, or sometimes all that's happened in the last year or a few years, and it's too late to look at things from that perspective, because the way the brain functions is very different than just feeling guilty or bad about not having done certain things or wishing that you could do things a little bit differently. The way things work is very much, it is a spontaneous, creative process of transformation that happens when you recognize the habits or the belief systems or the little constrictions that captures the way one interacts with life and communicates with life, and then constricts that attention in a certain way. That is actually structured in the way that the brain functions. So the brain then learns habits from repetition, and that is what a habit is. You know, the way that you keep repeating a feeling, for example, guilt or fear or I cannot or it's too difficult, can only be recognized when you honor that feeling in the moment or that experience in the moment, rather than later on afterwards and then feel the consequences of that feeling or thought or that experience. So in the moment, it's very important for people to do this, and hence why meditation or awareness through contemplation is so very useful, because it allows you to be aware of what you're doing to yourself and what you're doing to your energy and what you're doing to the situation that is around you, people, the way that you communicate, the way that you hold your body, and also the way that the brain is functioning. So for me, this is very, very important. The creative moment of this now, what is happening now, rather than yesterday or tomorrow. It's really walking your talk in this moment.
Yeah, I love that. The creative moment of this now, walking your talk in this moment. So let's talk. I've made just a few notes to kind of prompt me on directions we can go. But, of course, any direction this takes, I trust. We'll see how many of my notes we cover and how many we don't. But what you just talked about kind of led me to my note on the inner saboteur.
Exactly.
So You want to talk a little bit about that inner saboteur and how people can recognize its manifestation? And, you know, I know some people who are very, very stuck in this. They have very, very strong, and sometimes even punishing cycles where they really are hurting themselves or someone else over and over again. And yet they, even though they talk about it constantly and they understand the harm, they can't seem to break out of that. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. And not only, you know, harming themselves or other people, but sometimes, and this is more common than people think, allowing others to do that to themselves. So creating the space where you're not directly involved with the situation, so you're not harming yourself in a very direct way, you know, for example, overeating or neglecting your well-being, but you are allowing situations around you to create that space. So then people, even in relationships, sometimes that happens, you know, where you're allowing the space to create the inner saboteur energy to continuously create a sense of not being connected to this space or being empowered by honoring that which you truly are rather than what your mind or what your emotions perceive the situation to be. And, you know, I just thought to highlight this because, you know, sometimes people look for the problems within themselves, but of course it extends. Whatever you're doing, you're also involving the social environment that is around you and people, especially the people that you love or the people that you think that you love, and friends and colleagues at work and relationships, sometimes even your own family. So, you know, that is such a complex, very complex issue that it's difficult to generalize in a few sentences. But perhaps the thing that is very recognizable is happiness. If you're not happy, or if there is a part of you that is not happy in a real sense, you know, you're pretending to be happy because everything is functioning as it should, but deep inside there is a lack of this creative, spontaneous joy, just the joy for being alive, then the inner saboteur on some level is playing out through the ego or through various emotions or through various belief systems. You know, one of those belief systems is, I'm not good enough, or I don't deserve, or it just isn't possible for me, and it's too difficult. You know, the inner saboteur has many, many interesting personalities and can play out in many different ways, very subtle ways and very obvious ways. And if there is a lack of happiness, then for sure the inner saboteur is on some level influencing the experience of reality. So preventing reality from being in communication with your heart or in communication with your depth. And rather than that happening, there is a filter, and the filter is being influenced by the inner saboteur. So, you know, this is just a general explanation of happiness. And psychologists have spoken about this for a long time now, that especially in the Western culture, but also I've seen in my travels in many cultures, you know, Eastern culture and the native societies that I visited, there is a level of unspoken unhappiness that is just accepted as this is the way that life is. You know, we just have to accept it. And there is nothing more. Perhaps when you're a little child, you're not able to see the complexities of life. So then, in your ignorance, you can enjoy your childhood. But, you know, when you grow into an adult and you're faced with all those different and difficult aspects that adults have to deal with, then inner saboteur is just there, and you have to accept that as the reason why humanity cannot experience what I call just the natural bliss of being alive, the gift, appreciating the gift of being alive. And this may seem almost impossible to, like when I speak to some psychologists and some neuroscientists, And they just highlight that it is an impossibility, because actually the way the brain has developed is its structure is based on a negative bias. That means it always highlights the problem before it highlights happiness. You know, so it will get caught in the little problem that may just be a little problem, rather than see the general happiness that is present in one's life and appreciate that. And so neuroscientists and psychologists just say it's just the way that the brain functions, which creates the human mind, and this is just the way that human beings have developed and have evolved into being, and this is how we are today. And we can just try our best to be happy with the little enjoyable things that we have in life, but, you know, we can't expect bliss. And I don't believe that to be true. So this is where the inner saboteur is much more than just an old structure of the brain. The inner saboteur, I believe, is very helpful in transcending into grace.
Okay, so again, you know, one thing that's really interesting, because if people consciously look for where they're sabotaging themselves, you know, there's some very common areas they may notice, like eating habits, for example. Overeating or eating the wrong things is a huge problem in our Western society today. So people may very easily tune into that as where their inner saboteur is sabotaging them. But from what I heard you say, it can be much more subtle, in that anywhere where you are not naturally perfectly happy, your inner saboteur is at work.
Of course, that is the characteristic of an inner saboteur. The saboteur is highlighting a problem, saying, look, there is no reason to be happy because you have a problem that you need to deal with. And whether that problem be just a belief system or real makes no difference, because the energy of the mind, the emotions and the body then get very limited by that focus. And so if we repeat that behavior over and over again, meaning that we accept that as, when we are adults, we accept that as just the way that our brain functions, then we just can't think of a different way of interacting with the world or communicating to the world. So we believe that happiness can only be found in certain things. So we keep searching for those things outside of ourselves. We look for a better car or a better relationship or a better job or a better this or a better that or a better understanding of the world or a better religion or a better spiritual practice. But in the end, what the driving force is still the same, because we haven't recognized what is going on inside of ourselves.
Yeah, so like the inner saboteur, for example, if relationships is my thing, you know, I may find a relationship, I fall in love, I think it's great for 6 months or a year and a half, whatever, and then I begin to notice things about my partner that begin to really annoy me, and I think about them all the time, and pretty soon I just can't live with this anymore, so I leave, I find a new partner, and after 6 months or a year, the process begins again.
Yes, and that's many people's experience. And this is why we have such, I'm told, you know, such a high divorce rate, and probably it would be higher if certain people were courageous enough to admit that the relationship is, you know, not working. And that is the inner saboteur playing out, because, of course, as you highlight, a relationship is a relationship to oneself, and so oneself, if the relationship to oneself is not honorable or real, then that relationship is projected in relationship to the person that you love on the outside. So if you can't recognize your inner qualities of joy and bliss and happiness, then of course it's difficult to recognize that in your partner.
All right, so some people, as you know, have very little happiness in their lives.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah, so for me it's a little easier. Like even as you're talking, you know, I have gone through a lot of, I call it purification, I think you call it transformation, but a lot of letting go, a lot of clearing away, And I perceive myself in a fine tuning now. So like I can listen to you and I can tune in very easily on a couple places where I am not completely naturally happy and say, okay, I get that. But for some people, it's not going to be so easy because there's a whole forest of not happiness.
Exactly. And it's important for everyone, your listeners, to understand that everyone is unique. So for some, the journey begins at a very difficult point within oneself. And, you know, if you have been brought up in a way that is very dysfunctional, for example, if your family created an atmosphere where there was dysfunction, for example, father was alcoholic and mother was unable to create a space of love between the ages of 0 and 5, which is, of course, very, very important for the way that the brain develops and the way that your emotions recognizes references, then already there is a lot of unhappiness that you've inherited from that context that needs to be worked through. But basically the procedure of discernment is the same, but it's more complex because there is so much more that one has to look at than, for example, the little things that most people need to look at. The little things meaning if you know, your family was happy and you are joyful, then, you know, there are just a few things that one has to look at compared to if your family was very dysfunctional and you grew up in that atmosphere of dysfunction. So, you know, discernment in the end is the same, but it requires a lot more courage for someone who's gone through a lot more. And this is where compassion and love play into that space. And where it is important to perhaps work with a therapist or work with someone who is able to start from a point that is very easy to transform, rather than to look at all the problems all at once and say, oh, this is impossible. I can't do this by myself, or I can't even do it because, you know, I'm just totally unhappy with everything inside of myself. I don't have a reference that gives me the courage to even take that first step. And this is where it's important to work with a loved one, and whether that be your partner or a therapist or someone who has the wisdom and experience of having created a very clear discernment of what is dysfunctional in one's mind and what is creating problems in one's life, and the way forward to move beyond that, you know, how to recognize it as something that is communicating important wisdom and taking that wisdom to a higher level within yourself. I don't know if what I'm saying is making sense, because, of yes. course, it's difficult to put into words because it depends on each situation.
Well, and what I'm hearing you say is that some people are just going to need help from someone outside of them. You know, like in my case, you know, just briefly, I found a book called A Course in Miracles, and I started doing the workbook. And as I started doing the workbook to A Course in Miracles, I would say that therapist inside of me became very clear. I could have conversations with it. So I had my own inner therapist.
Yes.
But not everyone feels like they can connect with that inner therapist, although they all have it. Not everyone feels they can connect with it, and so then they need the outer therapist, is what I'm hearing.
This is very important. You know, some people are ashamed to go and ask for help. And in our culture, it's seen as like, if you go and ask for help, that somehow you can't do it yourself, or you're not strong, or you're not worthy of, worthy of some sort of recognition. You know, it's like, oh, you can't, I can't find the right word just in this moment. But actually, you know, asking for help is very important. Say, you know, you're alcoholic. You know, I'm just saying this because apparently there are many, many, many people who suffer from addictions, and alcohol is one of them. And it's just that the addiction is so very strong that it gets you every time. you know, whether it be alcohol, drugs, or whatever else. And you just, you can't find that inner strength by yourself. Asking for help is a sign of courage. It's a sign of recognizing that you are ready to discern the situation from clarity. It's not a sign of weakness, like some people say, you know, or imply. And this is why, for example, you know, people don't communicate so much of what is going on inside of themselves, because on some level it's seen as weakness. So we at least in England, you know, I'm sure it's the same in the Western world, but in England there is this facade, you know, it's called stiff upper lip, where you pretend everything is okay, and people say, and all good, yes, everything good, and there is no communication of really what's going on, because there is this sense of shame that one can't manage life, and so you're not going to share it with everyone until it's too late, and then, you know, you are lost in the addiction, and it becomes obvious to everyone else, and at that point, you just don't know how to ask for help. Some people then just get into a habit that, you know, they identify with the role of the inner saboteur. Mm. So this then becomes even more complex, because you can see people like this around in relationships, in relationships to many aspects of life, but also in relationships to their partner, where, you know, it gets to a point where it is important to ask for help. Whether that help is on the outside, or like you say, finding that inner guide within, it's the same, but it's important to ask.
Yeah.
And because without asking, you don't receive. And part of asking is creating clarity and discernment, and saying, I have a little problem here, and this problem is that I'm addicted to this situation, and I don't know what to do. My mind can't think of it. My emotions can't think of it. My ego just tricks me all the time, and I fall into the same old routine over and over again. So I don't know, really. I just can't find that wisdom within myself. And that is emptying the space, or in meditation it's called letting go. Letting go of the problem, so that you bring in wisdom, whether that be a therapist, a spiritual teacher, or someone that loves you very much, and from that space is able to create healing, because you're letting go and allowing that space to be open to healing.
All right, so there's a couple of questions that are popping in my mind that are related. You know, like we, you know, we mentioned overeating, we mentioned alcoholism. I mean, these are I think pretty obviously addictions, or unwholesome habit energies, as Thich Nhat Hanh would call them. And, yeah. And most people are very aware of those. But are there some others that are less subtle? For example, is poor health, or is mental illness? What if someone experiences like OCD, or, you know, what is it, bipolar, or are these the same thing, or are these things different than things like alcoholism and overeating?
Well, things can be generalized, and people say whatever, it's all the same. But actually, you know, mental illness, a lot of mental illness is the same as biological illness. So there is a foundation for mental illness that goes beyond just the way that you think, or belief systems that you may have inherited, or situations that you are facing within yourself. So there can be biological reasons for the situations that we're facing. And it's very complex, because those biological reasons could be from very simple things such as environmental pollutants that are now, for the first time in the evolution of human beings, we're now experimenting with our bodies in these very toxic environments that create, for some people who are sensitive, create biological interference, and this creates disturbance, either physical, so people, the health and well-being of people gets compromised, And we have all sorts of things such as chronic fatigue and all sorts of cancers which are rising, but also mental illness, which is sometimes connected to environmental causes. But beyond the environmental causes, of course, there is the genetic markers that you inherit from your family. And for some, this you're more, perhaps more inclined to get certain things in the same way as if your family is diabetic, you know, and your grandparents are diabetic and your great-grandparents are diabetic, you have those markers within your physiology, and it's more easy to trigger them off and create that within yourself if you're not careful. And this also happens with mental illness. But having said that, I do think that a lot of what is going on is due to not just the genetics and environment, but due to the way that we interact with ourselves and how we look at the world and how we communicate to the world and the way that we've learned to communicate to the depth of ourselves sometimes is very dysfunctional. And you see this, especially, you know, I was reading the other day, in Japan, they have a very high suicide rate due to the pressures and the expectations and the culture that values certain things very, very highly. And of course, suicide is a mental illness. You know, it's no person in their stable mind would contemplate such a thing. So, you know, there are other forms of diseases that we see today, and we see in children, you know, hyperactive children who now are medicated, and it's not understood that the environment is the environment meaning the environment within and the way that you think and deal with things is a very, very important trigger. And if that was changed on some level, I believe that a lot of mental illness and a lot of dysfunction in society would change dramatically. But of course, this requires a cultural shift. It's not just one person saying, okay, I will do this for myself, because we are social creatures. So in the end, it's not just one person changing or two people changing. There has to be a cultural shift that allows for, like in Japan, allows for people to understand reality from a different perspective. And until that happens, there will be people who feel so much pressure and will just take their own lives. Or there will be children who are just so hyperactive that they will need to be medicated. But having said that, we are empowered to change much more than what we believe is possible. And this has been shown very clearly in psychology, that, you know, just the way that you relate to yourself can change the severity of dysfunction, you know, whether that be mental disease, you know, real mental disease, psychosis and all the diseases, schizophrenia that we see a lot of today, but also, you know, the neurosis, obsession, you know, people look at psychosis and, you know, when you hear on the news of shootings and all these terrible things that happen, and it's one or two people doing that, and that becomes the focus. But obsessions, people are obsessed with repetitive forms of behavior that are dysfunctional. And I would say, without exaggeration, there would be like 50 to 60% of the population suffering from minor obsessive behavior that in itself is a mental disease if not addressed in a proper way. But it's not recognized because it's just seen as normal. And people just, I don't know, take sleeping tablet to relax, or take some sort of medication to relax, or take drugs, sort of drug that helps to keep that person going. So mental disease, you know, it, for me, is just, it, it's more than just one aspect or disharmony. There are so many levels to it. And I say this because if any of your listeners or if people know of others who suffer from mental disease, it is very important to get help and to address that. But if you recognize that within yourself, for example, stress or anxiety that gets to a point where you are not able to function, where you're just overwhelmed by the way the mind is repeating a certain thought or a certain feeling, then it is important also that one recognizes this and addresses it in a real way.
Yeah. Well, you're reminding me of a couple of things. One is, in the New Testament, and of course this is misunderstood, but Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives with his apostles, and he's talking about the end of these times. And they're asking about the signs of the end of these times. And one of the things Jesus talks about is until the end of these times, you know, brother will, as I think his son will betray father. And, you know, he's saying that all of these things are going to continue to happen until the end of these times. And of course, what he's trying to teach is that, you know, we need to be the change. And if we aren't the change, all of this dysfunction that we see in the world is going to continue.
And, exactly.
Go ahead.
No, and that's quite right, because you can't see it on the outside. It's as highlighted, it's within. And unless we recognize we are the change, we are empowered towards that change, then it just gets transmitted to future generations. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no. That's, I love it when you interrupt. I'm here to hear from you, and most of what I am saying, my job is only to trigger something in you to be said. So it works perfectly when you interrupt. So the next thing that it also reminded me of was kind of the flip side of that same coin of the Jesus story I just told in the Tao Te Ching. You know, the Tao Te Ching talks about how the family who practices the Tao will have harmony. The town, the village who practices the Tao will have harmony within the village. The government who practices the Tao will have harmony within the government. So if I am someone who has a child who, let's say, has ADD or bipolar or something like that, you know, in addition to maybe trying to get my child the best help I can find, I can remember that as I bring more harmony into myself, that's going to radiate somehow within the family. True?
For sure. That is such an important thing. And psychologists recognize that, you know, it's not one person who's suffering, that it's from within a context that a child is suffering. And this is not to blame the family, but, you know, whatever the parents and the brothers and the sisters do creates an environment in the energy field, what I call the space that we are sharing together, the space of reality that we are sharing together. And when there is a real movement towards love or towards opening to a depth of communication, then that depth of communication, even if not heard, for example, because someone is schizophrenic and, you know, they hear voices, and rather than the depth of love, the healing happens. Sometimes it takes a while, but the healing happens, and the transformation begins at a very basic level. And this is how nature works. It's not at the level where we want to see the transformation. It is the fundament that begins to change. And that means the constellation of the family begins to become more healing, and it's empowering. And so then, you know, disease is not seen as a negative. Disease is seen as a blessing for many, and as a way to come back to deeper communication that would have otherwise maybe not been possible had it not been for, you know, this situation that reminds the whole family that that communication is needed. So, you know, when you see things from that perspective, that it's not just one person. You know, the prisoner is in prison, is in prison in his own mind and or her own mind, But the prison is created by the culture that is around. And so as you free the culture from those unconscious aspects that are imprisoning oneself, then perhaps that creates a space of freedom within the prisoner to learn another way of interacting with the world, to recognize that there is something more than that negative that they're caught by in their own mind. And perhaps this is what happens also in mental illness. For sure, I've seen it happen in physical illness, that what doctors call miracles, what people say is just a miracle. You know, their health is transformed beyond what is possible in the medical milieu today, and things just change. That is beautiful, but what is important is that the fundament is what changes, and that is passed on to generations in the future. So even if the child remains schizophrenic, something changes which is carried on to future generations, and as you say, as the Tao says, within the village, within the town, there is a movement towards healing that allows for many things to begin to change that sometimes people don't see is related to the very little things that one person does in relationship to their child or in relationship to their children.
Yeah. Well, that you just reminded me of another line in the Bible, which I think is misunderstood, where Jesus says to his disciples, he says, you reap what you did not sow. And the way I understand that is, you know, even the grace that they have to want to sit and listen to him comes because of, you could say, the spiritual practice or the transformation of others that preceded them.
Exactly. That's very true. And a very important part of the book, Simplicity of Love, that love is much more than just a dualistic concept, you know, of this is something, and then that is the dualism of that something. You know, I want to find love, so that means I have to look in a very specific way to find that love on the outside in a relationship to a partner. Actually, when you create love within yourself, that space already invites much more to it. That love is just in itself a celebration of love that perhaps comes from before, because you recognize aspects of yourself that perhaps were hidden from your communication to yourself. And you begin to appreciate qualities within yourself that become highlighted within this open space of love, and that then become even more highlighted in relationship to the world or to your partner. And as you say, love is not dualistic. Love is a continuum that starts from long, long before you can even think, and continues to the future, far into the future, beyond the concept of time. As Einstein said, you know, into the multidimensional aspect of time. And that's what makes love an infinite quality that is always recognizable. This is why people like Jesus, you know, spoke of love as the greatest gift that we can recognize within ourselves. But it is always there. It's not that, you know, we find it. It's just that we recognize it.
Okay, well, in the Simplicity of Love meditation, I don't know if I remember the exact numbers, but you talk about how when we think we're making choices, we're only using like a 3 to 4% of our conscious capacity of our brain. And yet there's this other, you know, 97% or so that is not conscious to us, that is really doing the choosing. So we think we're choosing. For example, I might think I'm choosing making choices for what I perceive to be a better life, you know, to find a romantic partner that's just right for me or whatever. But actually, and we're getting back to inner saboteur again, there's this unconscious part of me that is really doing the choosing.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point. You know, besides unhappiness, the inner saboteur is unconscious.
So you also talk about then learning to allow the heart to choose instead of the mind, because the mind is operating on the 3 to 4% or whatever that number was, and the heart, was not going to choose with the inner saboteur. It's going to choose always for what's in the best interest of you and everyone. Is that true?
Yeah, the heart lives in the moment, but the unconscious usually is referenced in the past and also somehow projected the past into the future. So the unconscious is an accumulation of belief systems or ideas or feelings that are not related to this moment. They may seem to be related to this moment, but actually they've been accumulated throughout your development and childhood and adulthood and experiences, pictures. So the unconscious, even though it's 97% of the brain space, really in the end is the one that is making the choice. To make a choice from your heart requires that you are present to yourself, to really what is going on, not just to the impulses that come up to the surface from the unconscious. So, for example, making a choice because some part of you says, oh, yeah, I feel comfortable in this situation, but discerning, do I really feel comfortable? Why do I feel comfortable in this situation? What is the quality of comfort in this situation? Why am I feeling whatever it is that I'm feeling right now? And as you bring everything into this space of awareness, then what you're doing is allowing your heart to make the choice, because the heart is awareness in this moment. The unconscious is your past. And the conscious mind, the 3% that is thinking that it's made the choice, is influenced by the 97% that the forces that are coming up to the mind that says, ah, you've got to think like this, or ah, you've got to feel like this, or this is what you have to do, because if you don't do it this way, then this might happen. And then the fear and the inner saboteur play out on so many different levels. So you think you're making a choice, but in the end, it's just an auto response to the situation. It's not really you, because you're not aware of anything.
So
if you are, then you would make a very clear choice. Then when you see someone, you're not looking, like you were speaking about a partnership, if you see someone, then you're not looking at the externals of the person. Then you're connecting to the depth and heart of that person, and you're aware of the qualities that they that make them who they are. And so there is a recognition, because you recognize the real inside of you, there is a recognition of what is real inside of them. And that allows for love. That allows for a space of decision as to how to proceed with your thinking and your feeling and your interaction with that person beyond just the reactions of the unconscious.
So when I listen to the mind, when I let the mind define a problem, and then yeah. I listen to the mind's potential solutions about the problem, and even if I pick what I really think is the best solution, all of that thinking then has been driven by this, I'm going to call it negative unconscious. And so even though it seems like I made the best choice possible, nothing is really being helped through all of that mental deciding.
Yes and no.
Okay, go ahead with that.
Yes, it is important to think. So I'm not saying that thinking is a useless exercise, but it is important that the thinking is free of the forces that come up from the unconscious. And you have no way of recognizing those forces. So if most of those forces are what influence your actions, then thinking is a waste of time. And hence why awareness, or coming back to one's heart, is so very important. Because if you do that, then you're connecting to your awareness of what is really happening in this moment, not your belief systems or your thoughts or your experiences of past about what may be happening in this moment, but the reality of this moment. So it makes you super intelligent. You can look at things from a perspective that is what I would call a super brain. You pick up on information that otherwise is hidden because you're too busy, caught in the forces that are being played out through your belief systems and your reactions. In neuroscience, this is called receptivity. So when you're in a state of receptivity, you're picking up information that is relevant to the situation. When you're in a state of reactivity, then you're reacting, but you're often reacting to the situation from your own perspective, not from the reality of that perspective. So then, yes, it is a waste of time, but perhaps not. Perhaps it's good to get angry once in a while to recognize that you're an angry person. Mm-hmm. But if you keep repeating that behavior over and over again, and if that becomes your personality, and you think you are unable to move beyond that repetitive trait, then there is something wrong. And this is where discernment needs to come into the picture and ask yourself, you know, are these thoughts that I'm focused on, you know, I have reason to be angry because the world is a bad place and look at all the starving people in Africa and look at the world as it is now, you know, for sure I have a reason to be angry. You know, and all these justifications that are very, very valid on some level, but miss the point.
Well,
the point is that there is more to life than what the brain can understand if it's caught in a reactive process.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, what's coming up for me, of course, I'm seeing the brain almost made out of like Play-Doh, and so it can be easily formed, and that forming of is what I would call learning. And I'm seeing two possible inputs that the brain learns from. One is, I'm going to call it, I'll just call it the ego karma for now. You know, the ego karma, that would be the reaction. The other way that the brain can actually learn and be reformed is through awareness.
Exactly. That's what in neuroscience is known as learning, is the possibility to expand the gray matter in your brain so that this neuroplasticity grows to where the neurons are firing and wiring in a new way. That's what learning is, that you allow potential or the possibilities of learning to be open to you. So you don't fall back into an old pattern of doing things or thinking in the same old way, but you're open to new ideas. You have an open mind. This is in the mystical tradition that I work with, you know, this is one of the core fundamentals of spiritual practice, that you have an open mind and that you can integrate the information that you are learning and honor the curiosity of learning, so that learning is highlighted as an important aspect of spiritual practice. And that in itself removes the space of control, which is usually where the ego plays into your life and plays into all aspects of your life and begins to control the way you see and think and feel about things, because that is how the brain has learned to survive. You know, once you learn how to find food, the brain wants you to go back and find the same place and feel secure in finding the same food that you found before. And once you've learned to avoid that tiger in the woods, the brain is always on the lookout for the same pain triggers or the same situations that it has learned. But in a way, if you don't go beyond that, then you're just repeating the same thing over and over again, which some people call karma. And when you repeat it over and over again, it inevitably leads to unhappiness, because part of what it means to be a human being is the capacity to learn new things, to be open to new things. And if that is shut down because the unconscious mechanism is tied into the egoic realms of control, and you begin to control yourself, but also other people around you, which is really sometimes how society functions today. There are so many control mechanisms so that people do and think in certain ways. Then there is a general unhappiness, even if all our immediate needs are met, even if we've got the food and we've got the house, you know, and we're safe and we're feeding our bellies with the food that we need to eat to be comfortable. Still, we need more. And that more is the learning process, which is neuroplasticity, where the neurons begin to fire and rewire in a way that is totally different from what has been learned in the past. That is a wonderful thing because it creates a sense of joy and bliss and a sense of excitement about life. So thinking is important and useful to a point, but if it controls everything and the way that you live and see the world and even interact with your partner and your children, then something is lost. And that's such a pity because it just leads to disharmony and it leads to very often neurosis. And as we see in society today, an increased tension where there is violence because people react in negative ways, and where there are many situations that just are not harmonious because we're not harmonious within ourselves.
All right, so this again is getting to another question I asked last time we talked about. I asked you the question about, you know, is there a difference between enlightenment and just having a rewired brain? And I think that what I'm hearing now is, you know, just like as long as you are a human, a healthy heart is important, healthy lungs are important, the brain cannot be ignored. The brain is an important part of this physical realm for a human. And so what we really need to do then, the brain is really, I'm going to say the brain is a reflection of the way that we are currently learning, whether we are learning from conditioning, from karma, from the ego karma, I'm going to call it, or whether we are learning from awareness. And so what we need to do at the beginning of this transformation point is learn to change how we learn, whether we're learning from habits, from society, the habits of society, as well as the habits of family and everything else, or whether we're starting to step into that awareness and learn from awareness. That's going to change the brain, which is then going to change the entire human experience. Is this true?
Exactly. And that is what we want. In the end, even if we're not doing that, you know, even if we are getting caught by repetitive and old behaviors, everyone has a desire to come back home to this space of enlightenment, which is basically freedom. And for some, it's easy. For others, as you say, you know, there is a lot of work to be done. But in the end, the journey is the same for everyone. We're walking down the same road towards freedom. Everyone has a unique experience of that freedom, but in the end, the goal is the same. Whatever concept we put onto it, whether we use neuropsychology or whether we use spiritual traditions, Christian tradition or the Hindu tradition or whatever tradition, and put names and concepts onto the journey, in the end it's about freedom.
Yes.
And one way of learning how to be free is recognizing what you are, you know, the basics of who you are. And the way that the brain functions is very much how the mind is created. And if you recognize the fundamentals of how your brain functions, meaning that there is a negative bias within the brain, and if the ego gets caught in the negative bias, then it creates a whole distorted worldview, which leads to disharmony and sometimes psychosis and neurosis, then already we have a very real map as how to navigate within the complexities of reality and the challenges of reality that we have to face, you know, from just everyday living. There are all sorts of things that we have to interact with and communicate to. But if we have an understanding of the fundamentals, then discernment and clarity and focus can be placed where it's important. And this is what Einstein always highlighted, you know. Look at the problem, understand there is a problem, but then don't focus on the problem. You know, transcend into a space where the possibility of solutions exists. And that is beyond the problem. You know, it is in the space around it. And some people call that space the universal intelligence. Some people call that space the divine intelligence. I just call it our connection to love. And from that heartfelt space of connection, the mind can sometimes pick up on subtle messages, the language that is beyond concepts, that then get translated only when we have an open mind, only when we have an open heart, get translated into a language that we recognize and can make very tangible in our everyday communication to the world. So we can change anger to love because we are connected to this beautiful space, what I call divine intelligence or love, that is everywhere. But we need to transcend that space of the problem, which means we need to transcend the way that the mind is habituated to function. And this is possible, even though some people say it's impossible because we are slaves to the mechanical way that we are structured. And we know that in meditation and in contemplation and in dreams and spiritual practice, that there are many parts of the brain that get highlighted through MRI, for example, that then begin to function independently from the structure. And if we strengthen that, which is the gray matter in the brain, and begin to think from a new perspective, then we give birth, I believe, to a culture that sustains healing and well-being rather than holds on to the old unconscious behaviors and patterns that we still are struggling with in today's world.
Right. So one thing you mentioned in this last bit of talking was something about, you know, being called home to who you are or who we are. And, you know, based on the entire discussion, I would say that it's important to realize I am not my conditioning. I am not my reactions. I am not my beliefs, right? All of these things that are programmed into the brain through the ego karma, I am none of that. And then to begin moving into awareness. Now, would you say awareness is what we are? Would you say that's the truth?
That is a very important point, you know, to identify what you're not. So, for example, the alcoholic will remain an alcoholic as long as they are identified with that role. And when the alcoholic begins to recognize that I'm more than this role that I'm playing out in this moment, my addiction to whatever it is, alcohol or whatever it is, then already there is a clarity. So who are you if you're not the alcoholic? That is, of course, the big question that even in spiritual practice, you know, when you begin to discern very clearly, I'm not really the mind, even though it's me thinking. I'm not really the emotions, even though it's me feeling. I'm not really my body, even though this is my experience. Who am I? Then we get into very interesting parable. And this is the depth of spiritual practice. Letting go of what you are not, you know, identifying what you're not, so that the space is empty and that which you are begins to speak to you. So, am I the right person to say who you are? I think only your heart can say that. But the space needs to be empty so that your heart or the language of your heart can speak more clearly and in a tangible way, and you say, ah, of course, I am. And then there is no doubt what you are.
All right. So let's talk about meditation for a moment then, or, you know, for moments, minutes, however long it takes. But let's talk about meditation. So what I'm hearing then, if I can break it down just into some simple goals, is, you know, I'm going to say we have a habit of listening to conditioning, to our beliefs about the past, our reactions, you know, I'll call it again, ego karma. We have a habit of listening to ego karma and believing ego karma, living from ego karma, and now we realize that this has formed the brain in a certain way. It's created a lot of problems for me, my family, my company, society, everything. It echoes out. And the best thing that I can do is begin to learn from awareness. I need to shift how I learn from awareness, which will, of course, change the brain and will change me to a responder in the moment rather than a reactor, et cetera, et cetera. That's going to be, of course, helpful to me. It's going to bring me more joy, happiness, peace, naturalness to me, but it's going to radiate out to the family, out to my company, et cetera. It's going to be helpful to the whole. So I know that now. Meditation is a means to all of this transformation. Where do I start with meditation? How do I do that?
Yeah. This is why I write many books. For me, you know, there are three very important points in meditation. One is focus. So in the beginning, it is important to have some form of reminder that allows for focus not to get lost in thinking or feeling or drifting into the past or drifting into ideas of the future. And there are many ways to do this. You can repeat a mantra or like a phrase, you know, a beautiful phrase. And the repetition is simply to allow for your mind to be focused on one thing, not to get caught in the whole structure of thinking. Some people find it easier, and I think this is perhaps easier to start with for most, to focus on the breath, especially the out-breath. So breathing in, deep breath, relaxed, and then breathing out, and relaxing on the out-breath and prolonging the out-breath. This simple technique can be done, you know, for 10, 15 minutes. In the beginning, perhaps it seems a little bit strange, because if you're active and you're used to doing things, it may seem a little bit different. But with practice, it almost feels as if meditation helps the body to get more energy and more clarity. It's like a nap, like a deep nap, that allows for rejuvenation of the body. And the focus then becomes easier and easier, so the meditation goes deeper and deeper. So this is like the first step, perhaps, for those who are listening to your program, that can be put into practice and focus. The other is making sure that the body is relaxed. And this means just finding a comfortable position with your spine straight. So making sure that you're not crouched on the seat, and there is no need to sit in full lotus or in any sort of yogic position. If it's uncomfortable, you can just sit on a chair with your feet onto the ground and just feeling comfortably straight on the chair, so that your body is relaxed, but at the same time your spine is erect and not slouching. This allows for the nervous system to begin to function, as what happens in meditation is a movement of energy. And usually in the beginning it's through the nervous system, so through the spine, which is of course an extension of the brain. And when you do this, you focus through a sound or a mantra or a sentence or the breath, and you sit in this way, perhaps with your eyes closed and just silence, then your body just begins to create an interesting process, especially in your brain, where things begin to change. And in the beginning, that change will not be obvious, but some people may recognize this change after a while. Some people say, oh, you look very peaceful, or you seem very different. And it is simply because the body is transforming. So this is the beginning of meditation. I haven't actually written an ABC reference guide to meditation, because there are so many out there. But I've written many, many interesting practical meditations that people can try in the book, in all the books actually, except for Shaman's Wisdom. And there are different meditations that are helpful for different people. I find visualization to be very useful. simply because it connects us to our imagination, and imagination is one dimension of time that is very interesting to connect to when you're very focused. So many of the meditations outlined in the book have to do with imagining yourself in different situations and imagining your body relaxed and imagining different aspects of the energy around your body. And this very often leads to very tangible experiences.
One of the things that you talked about in the book that I found very interesting was the kundalini, or what people call the kundalini. And I believe you just said that was just the pure life force, awakening to the pure life force. And you also mentioned that we need to be ready for that. Can you talk a little more about that? You know, like, what do you mean by we need to be ready? How does one become ready, et cetera?
Well, you know, when I wouldn't, you know, create a fear out of it. So when I say we need to be ready, it's not like, you know, that if you're not ready, something not so nice may happen.
my body won't explode, right?
Yeah, some people believe that. And actually, there is all sorts of books written about Kundalini crisis and this and that. But actually, I in all my years of practice and all the thousands of people that I've worked with, I can't say that has any validity. It's just not valid. Basically, it is important for the body to be receptive. So when you're meditating, it's important simply to create a sense of receptivity so that the energy that is moving in your body, whether that be thoughts or feelings or physical movements, your body is constantly purifying and detoxifying, or more subtle movements, which difficult to speak about right now, but more subtle movements such as Kundalini energy, which is basically just the movement of energy through the spine. And this is happening all the time. But when the spine is open and receptive and the energy is moving very powerfully, then that experience is very different from just mere survival or managing to do the normal things that one has to do. One is then endowed with a very great deal of vibrant energy. And it's almost like, you know, if you're 50 or like 20, you know, you just feel like doing so much and your life is just transformed because you're receptive to everything rather than putting energy and reacting and challenging situations that drain the energy from within your body. So, you know, this is what I mean to prepare. Prepare means to make sure that you understand the fundamentals of meditation so that as meditation goes from a more practical, quietening down the mind, quietening down the emotions, coming back to a deep inner stillness, that space, that more subtle space within yourself, begins to recognize the movement of energy that is happening inside and around you. And, yeah, this is difficult to put into words, and I would say that my first experience of it, because I was always scientific, meaning and very down to earth, and my first experience with meditation was basically psychological. So, you know, the reason I was meditating was to just be very calm in my mind and be focused and be able to see perspectives from a very focused and clear way of thinking. But then I remember at maybe it was 16, I had this amazing, powerful experience, and I was ready for it because the mind was very focused and very clear, and I was ready for this more subtle experience where all of a sudden my understanding of time or my function within time changed, and it was almost like I recognized the past, but from within the past, so not looking back from the present moment to the past, and the future from within the future, and it was almost like my senses, the mundane senses of taste, smell, and hearing, were still there, but I could hear and recognize information from all around me, and this was just by breathing gently in and breathing out, and being receptive to information that is everywhere, in a way that was just I hadn't ever experienced before. And this was perhaps a little bit scary the first time, because it's as whenever you do anything that's new, and if it's very powerful, even when you fall in love the first time, perhaps it's a little bit scary for some. It was a new experience, and I was prepared for it. But if you're not prepared for it, perhaps that experience would somehow lock you into the idea that our meditation is very scary, because it brings about this change of consciousness or change of perception that I'm not ready for. But see, the consequence of meditation is that you slowly are ready to learn things from a different perspective, because the neurons in your brain begin to function in a different way, and they are more receptive to information on more and more subtle levels. And you, as you know, people who practice meditation for a long time, I was reading about this meditator who refused to go to have anesthesia in an operation, just wanted to experiment what it was like not to have anesthesia. I wouldn't recommend this.
Yeah, me neither.
But actually, they were able, simply because they had recognized all the triggers within their body and were able to put those to sleep through meditation, that they were able to go through the operation and they were awake. I think this was done in China. And, you know, these are the things that can happen. You know, meditation can make you more comfortable with aspects of yourself that are usually unconscious, and also within the realm of energy that usually are too subtle for the body senses to pick up. And this is why I say it's good to prepare, meaning that it's a step-by-step process. Meditation isn't just, you know, I want to be aware of, I don't know, some people say I'm meditating so that I can be aware of the aura or the chakras or, and, you know, it's too flippant to think in that way, because the process of meditation is much more profound, and such things are just consequences of going deep, more into a deep state of consciousness.
Well, in fact, what you just said was leading into my next question. Again, awakening together is, you know, we're a joined organization, which means we're joined in purpose. In fact, we consider ourselves a church, because we're joined in one purpose, and that common purpose is awakening to truth, you know, just knowing who we are, as you stated, in a very true way. So the primary purpose of meditation then for someone who is in awakening together, although there may be exceptions, there may be people who still want better health or certain things, but the primary purpose of meditation would be to realize the truth rather than to be fooled by falsehood. So do you have, knowing that primary purpose of meditation, is there anything more you would like to say, maybe as advice or recommendation to the members of Awakening Together?
I think that is the most important point, that we're not alone. You know, when you sit and meditate, I believe that then meditation is extended beyond the self into the energy field that connects us to everyone and everything. And just simply by recognizing that you're not alone, that when you sit in meditation, that you are part of a greater connection that we call life, or just the miracle of life, already creates a sense of gratitude and a sense of, it's important that what I'm doing, okay, I might get more healthy, I might increase the functions of the body so that the detoxification happens, as has been shown in science, in a very powerful way, and the brain actually grows instead of shrinks, as it happens for most people. You know, as you age, the aging brain is then reversed through meditation to a state of more alertness. All this is interesting, but the most interesting thing is our connection to a depth that we can share with ourselves in the way that we are, in the way that we talk to people, the way that we feel about people, the way that we see people, but also in our what we give to this place that we are sharing. And what we give then is this extension of love from within that is very tangible, very, very tangible to just so many, many, many aspects of life. And the more people that meditate, the more people that come back to realizing the truth of who they are and letting go of the ignorance or the falsehood of belief systems that so very often entangle our minds and our emotions into so many games that waste so much of our time. Already by purifying this and coming back to our truth, then we are clearing the space, and the space becomes lighter and more able to express what I believe to be the harmony of humanity. And I think this is already the best reason to meditate. All the rest comes with practice and is wonderful, but just giving so much is the reason why I teach meditation and why I write the books that I do, because I believe the more you give, the more you give from a real deep space, the more life is so much more interesting and beautiful. You can't describe it really in words. It becomes just a gift to be part of life.
All right, Tony, we are beginning to run out of time. Unfortunately, this time we didn't get disconnected, so we can wrap up in the appropriate way. There are probably two things I'd love from you as we wrap up. First of all, I think this discussion was very exciting. I think we did exactly what our intention was to go deeper than the first discussion. The first one was a nice beginning, but this one was really sweet, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
After hearing this discussion, there may be people who want more, you know, from you as a guide, maybe more from your book, or maybe I think there's some kind of a center you have. Now, we've talked about the book, The Simplicity of Love Meditation, which I think Awakening Together members would enjoy. Now that you understand us a little more, is there another book that you would like to recommend for Awakening Together members?
I would say that's the best book.
Okay.
It's in depth and it goes very much into many, many beautiful things. There is a detox book which speaks about interesting ways to help the body become more healthy. And there is a book called Ancient Wisdoms. And that is a very easy book to read, and it has quotes, very interesting quotes that act as a, perhaps, you know, one day you, when you don't have time to read so much, you open the book to page 5, and there on page 5 is a beautiful quote that speaks to you, and that can be somehow the reminder of how to bring joy and happiness into your life. But all these books are available on Amazon, and I think in America it's Amazon.com, and in the UK it's Amazon.co.uk. But also on the website, TonySamara.com, there are interesting resources, and one of them is YouTube, which there are some free YouTubes that people can watch. And the website itself speaks about many, many interesting topics, you know, from ways to meditate. So there are a few meditations there to food, which I feel is an important part of healing, you know, how we eat and what we put into our bodies. And then there is much more, you know, there is a whole website in many languages that explains all these things. There is the blog. And the blog, I often write a few interesting things on that may appeal to your readers. But in the end, really the most important thing is the practice. And I think you can do that wherever you are and within whichever context that you are comfortable with. And hopefully, you know, what has been shared today, some of those points can be put into practice. They are so very easy and then they make sense. And I'm more than happy for people to look at the website and, you know, just connect in any way that they feel comfortable. I do retreats, but mainly in Europe, so there are longer retreats for people who wish to go deeper in practice together. But also sometimes there are retreats online. So on the website there are certain retreats that you can join and, you know, at any time from wherever you are, whatever time it is in the place that you're listening from, and you can do this with a group of people, for example. There was one retreat that was filmed, and it's very nice to download, and that's on the website also.
Well, and we do have listeners in Europe as well as listeners who are willing to travel to Europe. So if somebody wanted to know more about the retreats, exactly where on your website would they look?
Just in the program page, and actually the next retreat, the big retreat, is in September in Portugal, in the Algarve, and it's in a beautiful place, a very powerful place. It's right up in the Algarve. I don't know if you know the Algarve. That's the southern part of Portugal, which is right on the edge of Europe, facing down towards the Atlantic, down towards Brazil, and it's a very special place. It's full of energy, and the place that we conduct the retreat in is very beautiful. It's right on the beach. So, and September is a good month in the Algarve because it's still warm and enjoyable. So yes, that's the next big retreat happening in Europe.
All right. Well, you know what? Thank you very, very much, Tony. As I mentioned, this has been very exciting. I enjoyed it. I'm actually very happy that the laptop battery died last time and we were disconnected, because that's what led me to say, well, let's just do it again then.
Yes, it's wonderful. And there are so many interesting topics, you know, and perhaps, you know, your listeners can highlight something that they want to go deeper into.
Yes.
Meditation is a lifestyle. It's not just about closing your eyes and meditating as such. You know, there's so much to it.
Yeah, if you're open to it, you know, maybe we will talk again sometime, because it has been very exciting. You're very clear, so, and very simple, you know, in how you speak about things. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, have a wonderful for you evening, and I am going to begin my day, and I will be in touch.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah.